Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the new screensavers is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. The new screensavers is brought to you by WordPress. Reach more customers when you build your business website on WordPress.com. Plans start at just $4 a month and get 15% off any new plan at WordPress.com/NSS.
Earthquake alerts before they happen. A supermassive black hole has thousands of friends. And spring cleaning with tech. Live from the Twit Eastside Studios in beautiful Petaluma, it's the new screensavers.
And I sometimes go under the name of Ian Thompson.
The Scotsman's here. This is episode 151 for Saturday, April 7th, 2016. Hi, Ian. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Always a pleasure.
Stand back. I'm going to try science.
It works every time. Well, nearly every time.
We actually have a scientist on, so you might want to.
I know. This is why I wore it.
You know, okay.
Make him feel at home. This guy's a respected scientist.
Coming up, what if you got an earthquake alert? What if you could be aware of an earthquake coming, say, 30 seconds before it actually hit?
It's a huge fear for someone who didn't grow up in this neighborhood.
There is a way, it turns out. We can't predict earthquakes, but we can sense P waves.
I've got one coming on
right now, actually. The founder of Early Warning Labs is here to talk about their new app, Quake Alert 2, which will give you up to 30 seconds of warning on your smartphone before the earthquake hit. And they actually they staged a test a couple of days ago in Los Angeles, and it worked. It's actually really quite cool.
Odds are that you know about the black hole at the center of our Milky Way galaxy.
What?
Yep, there is one there, but there's more, in fact. We'll be speaking to astrophysicist Chuck Haley, who'll be joining us to explain how his team have found thousands of them.
That's actually really fascinating. Brand new research just came out. Where do you put your Google Home? Where do you stick your Google Mini? Well, if you're running out of shelf space or space anywhere, Jason Howell will show us some clever ways to mount yours. I did not write that.
And it's that time. Megan Maroney shows you how to spring clean with tech.
Plus, we got a Wi-Fi hotspot question coming up in our call for help and more mailbag questions. But let's start with the big news stories of the day. The Mark Zuckerberg apology tour continues, now 14 years in running.
Yes.
Very funny article in Wired magazine, Zeynep Tufekci, pointing out that Mark's been apologizing since 2003, even before he wrote Facebook. Mark was a Harvard freshman and wrote something called Face Smash.
Yes.
Do you remember seeing this in the or Face Mash? I guess it was.
Yeah.
Do you remember
he was reading scraping this? Up people's images and sticking.
Yeah, he scraped pictures from the Harvard Facebook and said hot or not. It was basically a hot or not app,
yeah,
which wasn't original. He didn't invent that either. And he got in trouble. And you may remember in The Social Network, they even talked about this.
Yep.
He had to write an apology in the Harvard Crimson. And if you read the apology that he wrote in the Harvard Crimson, it sounds eerily familiar.
Yeah.
Let me pull it up here so I can do a dramatic.
It's just been interesting watching them squirm all week. And he's just shown himself to be a weapons-grade wanker when it comes to dealing with other people's.
Well, it does make you, when you read these apologies, and it's been going on literally for 14 years.
Yeah.
And you understand that Mark has cleverly arranged Facebook stock so that he has 100% control of the company.
Oh, yes. He's been very clear about
that. It starts to make you wonder about Mark's, I don't know, what's the word, veracity? Here's the apology. He wrote back in 2003, I hope you understand this is not how I meant for things to go. I apologize for any harm done as a result of my neglect. Consider how quickly the site would spread and its consequences thereafter. I definitely see how my intentions could be seen in the wrong light. Fast forward, 2006, the launch of the news feed. People said, wait a minute, all my posts are now public all of a sudden. This quote, this was a big mistake on our part, and I'm sorry for it. We really messed this one up. We did a bad job of explaining what the new features were and an even worse job of giving you control of them. 2007, the Beacon advertising system.
Yep.
This is the one where all of a sudden my friends were seeing Leo Laporte just bought adult diapers. Maybe you'd like to, too. And this was a little annoying to many people.
Just a wee bit. Yeah.
Just a wee bit. Pick the word very aptly. Just a wee bit. 50,000 Facebook users signed a petition saying, stop invading my privacy. Here's Mark's apology. You know, he at this point, he could start using boilerplate. We simply did a bad job with this release, and I apologize for it. I'm not proud of the way we handled this situation. I know we can do better. And on and on and on. Every time.
Yeah.
It's, oh, and now we didn't think it would be so bad. I'm sorry. We won't do it again. And then they do it again.
Yeah. I know. It's a pattern that we're seeing here. You know, they get caught, then they apologize and promise to change things
around. I think it's a personality flaw, frankly, in Mark Zuckerberg.
It's not until they get caught that they actually, that this ever becomes an
issue. So the new one is what? That Mark Zuckerberg sent all the, you know, anytime Mark had messaged you, and apparently he messages people a lot, it's in your Facebook Messenger, and I think people probably saved it, right? I got a message from Mark. All of a sudden, they started noticing these messages disappearing.
I know, and it looks like a one-sided conversation has been going on.
You're not talking to anybody. There is no Mark Zuckerberg. Who are you talking about?
But initially, my understanding is that initially they denied that this was going on. And then once they actually got caught, it's like, well, it is going on, and we're going to roll it out to everyone.
Guess what? You all get it.
But, I mean, okay, you suffer from trolls more than many people. And if somebody starts trolling and slamming someone on Facebook and then deleting the evidence, doesn't this seem like this is going to backfire somehow?
Well, Twitter's smart in that sense. You can't delete tweets globally. Well, I guess you can.
But they're
always
set it up.
Anyway, I have a solution for this on Facebook. I deleted my Facebook account. So that's that. Nobody's going to message me.
I know. It's one of the ways to go. I unfortunately have a lot of friends in the UK who I use it to keep in contact with, but there's got to be a better way, and I'm desperate for a social network that isn't quite so grabby with your data.
I think that's really the bottom line in all this. We need to come up with ways to do this. I don't think you can trust Facebook to fix itself. I know many people argue. We had a big fight, Jeff Jarvis and I. I slept on the couch last night. We had a big fight because he said, no. He pointed out Siva Vaidyanathan, who said, this is white privilege to say get rid of Facebook. He said many people in developing world, I guess, keep track.
Excuse me. We gave you this bloody country.
Oh, that's right. Keep track of family and friends this way. My reaction to that, though, is what did you do 10 years ago?
Yeah.
Weren't you able to keep track of family and friends?
Kind of. We used to meet down the pub, but that's not really so much of an option. Now I'm like 5,000 miles away. But
so you really need you need something like Facebook.
And something like Facebook, yeah. But I would like to do it without dealing with such a company that is being such egregious wankers about this.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what to say. The 14-year apology tour continues. Apple has now announced...
Kind of.
So a year ago, Apple brings in 5 tame journalists to explain to them, oops, we made a mistake. When we designed the Mac Pro in 2013, we designed something that was, due to thermal considerations, unupgradable. We can't fix
it. Thermal considerations.
We're going to throw it out and start over. And Apple said last year, we're not going to have it. This year in 2017. Mm-hmm. Fast forward a year later, almost exactly, Matthew Panzerino back at Apple headquarters. He's at TechCrunch. Apple says 2019. But then they take him behind the curtain. Look at all the people. We're using all these pros and we're watching them what they do with the Mac Pro because we want to make something. It's good. This is the line. We're going to shape it by workflows, by your workflows. And, you know, Matthew got nice access to Apple. And so he said, I'm just glad Apple's doing it this way and blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile,
Mac users are really annoyed that it's taking them this long.
I bought that 2013 Mac Pro, you know. Yeah. I mean, that thing is obsolete and it's still being sold by Apple.
Yep.
They do have the iMac Pro. But Mac, a lot of pro users want an upgradable modular system.
Apple has specifically designed their systems to be unupgradable as much as possible. So you've got to have the special screw heads to actually get the things off. You've got to have the heat guns.
You need suction cups to actually get into the iMac.
Yeah, no, I mean that.
You need to have Mission Impossible
and
grade
a heat gun in some.
Suction cups to remove the screen. Anyway, really the question in my mind, and we talk about it a lot on MacBreak Weekly, is really whither the Macintosh. And I'm more and more of the opinion that another story that came out this week, Apple's going to start designing its own chips by 2020 for the Mac.
They've been talking about, because we covered that, and said, well, hang on, they said that in 2012, 2013, 2015, and now they're saying it.
Well, they do great chips for iOS.
Yeah. Certainly.
So it wouldn't surprise me. Intel stock tumbled, even though it's only 5% of Intel's business.
Well, Intel's in a deep... I think there are deeper reasons behind Intel's people willing to share it. Because their below 10 nanometer processes are off.
They can't do it.
They can't do it.
They can't do it.
They cannot get it right. Samsung is eating their lunch on that score.
Yeah.
They've missed out on the mobile market yet again. Their servers, they've pissed off a lot of people with Meltdown and Spectre.
So far, though, nobody's really saying ARM is our choice on servers. Intel still owns the server space.
We've had a couple of people
who are looking at it.
Particularly on the cloudy side of things, ARM processors seem to work on that score.
Anyway, I think this is just yet another indicator that Apple's commitment to Macintosh and Mac OS is fading.
They want everyone on tablets.
That's where they're headed.
Stick a keyboard on it. It'll be fine.
Here's the last story before we get to the meat of the matter, our show, and we have a lot of great guests for you. This is something that concerns me a little bit. Ars Technica writing a little bit about the Department of Homeland Security, which has apparently put out a bidding process. They're looking for people who will help them build a database of journalists and media influencers all around the world.
I, for one, welcome on you, Overlord. I have no problems with this at all. I'm now, yay, okay, go America.
Some of this I understand. The idea would be that it's global. So if journalists are writing about Department of Homeland Security in a negative way, I don't understand this at all.
Well, no, I mean, I can kind of understand it from a public relations point of view. Every PR company should have a database of journalists that they deal with. That's kind of de rigueur.
But this is more like spying on it.
This is, if this journalist, if we want to check out this journalist, let's see what they've written, let's see what views they have, and they can do this around the world. And then the response to it worries me far more than the original news.
Yeah, this is what concerns me, is there is this tenor in the country, thanks to our administration, that many journalistic entities, anybody who says anything critical of the administration
is
fake news. So this was the Department of Homeland Security's tweet. Is this how we communicate now? Is this really how our government communicates with us? From Tyler Q. Holton, who's apparently...
winner of the third most ridiculous name in the White House.
The spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security. Despite what some reporters may suggest, this is nothing more than the standard practice of monitoring current events in the media. Any suggestion otherwise is fit for tinfoil hat-wearing black helicopter conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
The official response from the Department of Homeland Security... Now I'm really suspicious.
Yeah, I know. You're just like...
Before it was like, okay, they're just monitoring stuff. Now I'm thinking they're protesting a little too hard.
Well, yes. Also, the tinfoil hat thing is weird because we did a story about 5 years ago.
Somebody doesn't work.
Somebody tested out tinfoil hats actually amplify signals to the brain. So there is the conspiracy theory that, in fact, the whole tinfoil hat thing is to get people to wear tinfoil hats so you can get the brain waves. But
I just worry because I think one of the things that's really been the strength, the backbone of our republic in this country is a free press. We stole our free press from you, and thank you very much. And
made it, because I mean, there was a key case over here.
We have a First Amendment, which you don't have.
No, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, you've actually got an amendment in the Constitution.
So government shall not abridge
by the founding fathers.
Yeah. Because I think that's that's one of the really, I think, the backbones of a republic, and it's kept us safe for so many years. And as a member of that free press, I really want to keep it that way. And it's chilling to think of a government agency monitoring United States journalists, by the way, bloggers and podcasters as well. That's cause for concern. You're on the list. Yeah, I got you on my list. Anyway, we're going to talk about black holes in just a little bit. What an amazing discovery. Thanks to science, but first, and earthquake warning, early warning system. But first, let's talk about how you can become a blogger that the DHS will be interested in. This is WordPress.com. That's where I post my blog. I love WordPress. I know so many people use WordPress. I know so many publications that use WordPress. In fact, 30% of all the websites in the world, 30% run on WordPress. I use WordPress.com because I get the great WordPress software. I get the great WordPress hosting, all the plugins, all the templates, and 24/7 customer support there to help me 24/7 Monday through Friday, on weekends too if I've got any questions. I've used them. It's fantastic. WordPress also offers powerful e-commerce. So if you want to be on in business on the web, you can have everything from a big buy it now button to complete online store easily, simply. Plans start at just $4 a month. My blog, leolaporte.com's on WordPress. You know, even Steve Gibson, who runs servers, does his own hosting, when he decided to do a blog, he put it on WordPress.com, and he still uses it because it's just the easiest way to do it. When you want to expand your business's online reach, WordPress makes it easy with built-in SEO, social sharing, specialized plugins to meet any needs. I use Google's AMP plugin so that my site loads super fast on mobile. No wonder 30% of all websites run on WordPress. You can have a Facebook page. That's fine. You can have a Twitter account, of course. But what you really need is one place on the web that's yours, that you call your own. Whether you're an individual, whether you're a business, you've got to have that website. And you got to make it a WordPress. Go to WordPress.com/NSS and get 15% off any new plan. Go to WordPress.com/NSS to get started. It's simple. It's fast. It's fun. WordPress.com/NSS. And we thank WordPress for their support of the new Screensaver Show. Let's get on the horn right now with Chuck Haley. He's an astrophysicist, co-director of the Columbia Astrophysics Laboratory. Hey, Chuck, good to see you. Thank you for joining us
today.
Good
to see you guys.
This is exciting. And just this. Now, how long have you been working on this?
Oh, we've been working on this off and on for about 3 years.
It's one of those things that the mainstream media gets a hold of, and all of a sudden it's a huge story, right?
Right.
3 years in. I think we talked about Chandra not so long ago on this show. Tell us about the Chandra X-ray Observatory.
Well, Chandra is an observatory that launched about 18 years ago, so it's been up there for a long time. But it's got the probably the best pair of eyes of any telescope. It's got very good angular resolution. So when you're looking in very crowded fields like the galactic center that have a lot of X-ray sources, it's really good for figuring out what's going on. So that's why we decided to use it.
X-ray as opposed to visible light.
Correct. The galactic center is filled with a lot of gas and dust and is just like a fog. You can't really see any optical light coming out of there, but the X-rays, just like they cut through your body, they cut right through that gas and dust so that you can get a nice signal from objects in the center.
Is that the Milky Way, the gas and dust you're talking about?
Exactly. Just what you see, you know, when you look up at night, you see all those stars, but also there's a lot of gas and dust in there. And that's what I'm talking about. The light doesn't go through it very easily.
Yeah.
Now, the X-rays that you picked up from this, is that Hawking radiation or is that something different?
No, Hawking radiation is something a little bit different. Nobody's actually seen Hawking radiation. And if they had, that would make this story look like it was a dwarf story. I only wish we'd found Hawking radiation. But no, these are X-rays that are coming from the vicinity of the black holes themselves that we found.
So what did the X-rays tell you? Tell us about these black holes. Haven't we always thought that the galaxy center was a creamy, delicious black...
I think we're thinking chocolate bar.
Sorry. I haven't had lunch. Was at the center of the galaxy. That's not news.
Right. There's always been a supermassive black hole there that's about 4 million times the mass of the sun, and we've known about that for a long time. But the question, basically, for the longest time, people have theorized for more than two decades that there ought to be this large number of little black holes, maybe say 10 times the mass of the sun, all orbiting around the supermassive black hole. But there hasn't really been a lot of evidence for that.
Is it that the massive black hole attracts other black holes? Why would these little black holes be there?
Well, there's a couple of theories. One is that they were formed kind of farther out and sort of sunk into the center because as they bump into other stars, they lose energy. And just like if you dump sediment into a glass of water, the heavy stuff sinks to the bottom. These black holes will sink up close to the supermassive black hole.
So you could think of it as the bottom of the galaxy in a way.
It's where kind of everything wants to sink.
Right.
And that's one idea. The other is that there's a disk around that supermassive black hole, And that's a good place to make big stars. And so you get the big stars. They die. They turn into black holes. They grab a companion star that's running by them. And that's the kind of system that we detected.
Okay. Would LIGO be any use in detecting when these black holes sort of crash into each other and if they hit the big one?
What's LIGO?
The gravity wave.
That's a great question. I'm sure everybody knows about gravitational wave radiation. And I think one of the neat things that's going to come out of this is the theorists will be able to predict how many events that LIGO ought to see, say, out of the center of other galaxies. Because if you see a lot of black holes in our galaxy, we're really kind of a normal run-of-the-mill galaxy, so you ought to see these things everywhere. So I'm imagining that LIGO will eventually see some events that come from these black holes that are orbiting supermassive black holes in other galaxies.
So you mentioned this pair, black hole and another star. That was critical to your discovery.
Yeah, before we started, you were asking, how do you see a black hole if it's black?
It's black, right? Definition of a black hole is it draws all light into it, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. If the black holes are isolated, and there were supposed to be like 10 or 20,000 of these things, and they don't make anything very nice, because like you say, the light doesn't get out. They do eat gas and dust, and they make a little bit of X-rays, but so few they're hard to see. So the trick was we decided to look for the black holes that have a star, so that you have a black hole and a star orbiting each other, because then gas can come off the star and make a swirly little disk around the black hole.
Oh,
and
it's cool.
There you go. It's very hot. Off to the right. Yeah. And so you can get X-rays from that type of system. Now, that only happens for maybe 5% of all the black holes, but those are the ones that we can go after and detect in X-rays.
And then you can extrapolate from there onwards to get a general figure of the numbers that are available.
Precisely. That's what we did. I mean, you know, you have to make two huge extrapolations. One is, you know, the galactic center is very far away, so we miss a lot of the fainter objects. So that got us from a dozen up to maybe 300 to 500. We're missing most of them because they're too faint. And then only about 5% of the black holes are able to capture a star. So multiply by another factor of 20, and you're up around 10,000, which is actually what the theorists had been predicting.
So there's the massive black hole and then 10,000 smaller black holes around it.
Right.
Holy cow.
So basically, if you're in a spaceship, never go through the center of
the galaxy. Don't go that way.
Not a good place to be. Exactly.
Wow. And how did they predict that number? That's an interesting number. Where did that come from?
Well, you know, you have if you're looking, basically, there's a whole bunch of stars out there. We know the big ones form black holes. We know how many stars there are, so we can predict from the number of very massive stars how many of them will form black holes. And then you just, from there, you can figure out how many settle into the center of the galaxy.
So this is a cool thing to discover. And obviously, that's why you got all the mainstream media attention. But what is the value to you of studying this? What can we learn?
Well, you know, for me, the first thing was just it was kind of a really neat mystery because, you know, the theorists had said there were all these black holes there and why didn't we see them?
Right.
So it was really kind of fun to solve that kind of mystery. The other thing, though, is you know, gravitational wave astronomy is the really hot subject now.
Oh, yeah.
And I think this discovery is really going to help them figure out how many type of gravitational wave events you can see in the centers of other galaxies. And theorists have calculated that, but they can kind of use the numbers we have now to really pin down what that number is in other galaxies. So I'm just an ordinary, humble X-ray astronomer, but it's good to be able to help out the gravitational wave people because they're kind of going to be the hot topic for the next couple of decades.
I was going to say, ordinary, humble astronomer, these things do not go together in the way that you think.
Okay.
That's pretty cool. And, of course, it's always great to be able to talk about black holes. There's something about that grabs people's attention, especially kids who are interested in science. When you talk about black holes, they're just fascinated.
It's an amazing concept.
And they want to know more. And I think that's, if nothing else, the fact that there's, well, thousands of black holes at the center of our galaxy is pretty exciting news.
And then when Andromeda collides, then we're going to get even more.
Please don't say that.
Even more, yeah.
It's great to talk to you. Thank you so much, Chuck. I appreciate
it. Thank you very much indeed.
Chuck Haley's an astrophysicist.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, co-director of the Columbia Astrophysics Laboratory.
You see, this is respect. You know,
that is pretty awesome.
You don't need to be humble when you've got a title like
no
that.
No need to be humble. Thank you. Thank you for spending some time with
us,
Chuck.
Guys.
We appreciate it.
Thanks
Take
for
care.
Me on.
Wow.
Bye-bye.
What do you say, 1,500?
10,000.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of things getting pulled apart. And
oh, it's yeah, and each one of those is a star that died and then collapsed in on itself and created a super intense gravitational field.
Do you remember all the fuss when we thought that CERN was going to, the Large Hadron Collider was going to create little
mini
black holes?
Right.
Never happened yet, but at the same time, you know.
So you think maybe the aliens created a Large Hadron Collider and then turned the center of the galaxy into a massive no-go zone?
Well, I don't know. See, I grew up with Disney, the Disney film, The Black Hole, which I understand if you go down it, will take you into a weird landscape of wrecked machinery.
I think that's where Mary Poppins and Dick Van Dyke live.
Hopefully so, because his accent was painfully bad.
It wasn't an English accent. It was
Hello,
a Black Hole
Mary
accent.
Poppins.
Hello, Mary.
It's kind of like me trying to do a Texan accent. It doesn't work.
All right. Coming up in just a little bit, we're going to find out how do you can tell about an earthquake before it happens? It's something of great interest to us here in earthquake country.
Hey, as someone who's moved to earthquake country and having never had...
Well, we don't have tornadoes. We don't have hurricanes. But we have earthquakes. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about early earthquake detection in just a second. But first, it's spring cleaning time. Megan Maroney has some ways tech can help you.
Spring has sprung. I know, because I have allergies, which means it's time for some spring cleaning with my favorite devices. Spring is a great time to clean out your closet. I have two apps for that, Poshmark and ThredUp. Now, if you think you might have some items in your closet that are worth something to someone else, then you can sell them. You could use Facebook Marketplace or a Facebook group or even Craigslist. But you're going to find yourself doing a lot of back and forth that wastes a lot of your time. And maybe you don't want to deal directly with people face to face. And why should you have to in this day and age? You should not. Poshmark is an app and a website that will let you list your items and people can buy them at that price, or they can make offers which you can accept, counter, or decline. It's a lot like eBay, but there is no time limit on the auctions. Once you've agreed on a price, Poshmark will email you a mailing label. You package up your item, slap on the label, and drop it in the mail. Once the buyers receive your item, the money is deposited in your Poshmark account, less Poshmark's 20% commission. Now, that might seem like a lot, but it's worth it to me not to have to deal with a bunch of Facebook or Craigslist buyers who may or may not show up when they say they're going to, and it could very well be serial killers. Who knows? Poshmark also immediately takes money from the buyers before you send the item. That way, as soon as the item is received and accepted, they release the money to you. They will also ensure that your buyer gets what you said you were selling. So if your Galaxy Note 7 burned a giant hole in that pocket of your guest jeans and you don't disclose that, Poshmark will allow the buyer to send back the item to you and then give them their money back. My only issue with Poshmark is that I end up buying more items than I sell. But I feel pretty good about that, buying clothes that were previously worn, you know, for the environment. If you don't want to mess with taking brightly lit and styled photos of your items, order a free bag from ThredUp. Fill it with your gently used but still good condition women's and children's clothes, and they will pay for shipping. If they sell your items, you'll also get a small commission. If they don't sell them, they'll donate them or recycle them responsibly, and you don't have to think about it anymore. So you cleaned out your closet and your kid's closet. Now it's time to sit back and let a robot do your vacuuming. Everyone always talks about Roomba, Roomba this, Roomba that, but I've been using the Neato BotVac D5. And I love it. It's got a flat front edge, which means it gets into corners more easily. It's also cheaper than the Roomba, but at around $600, it's still not cheap. I have a dog and three kids with muddy sneakers, soccer cleats full of artificial turf, and just general detritus. Nothing makes me happier than knowing that while I'm at work, the Neato, who we have named Betty, is sucking up all that debris so I don't have to sweep up at the end of the day when I would rather be watching Netflix. I can schedule the Neato to vacuum at a certain time of day, every day, or a certain day every week at a certain time. I can also just start her anytime I want, wherever I am, with my phone. And when she's done, I can check the coverage map on my phone to see where she's been. I recommend scheduling her when you're not at home because she is very loud. If you're worried about her getting stuck, that can be a concern. She will notify you if she can't get out from under the couch or if her battery is low. But unless someone else is at home, you'll have to wait until you get home to do anything about it. Despite that, I am extremely happy with my Nido. And if you're interested in finding out more about why I so love her, feel free to email me or message me on Twitter. I am Megan Maroney. So, the robot can vacuum the floors, but what about the rest of the household chores for spring cleaning and the rest of the year? Are you going to do them by yourself? Unless you live by yourself, I certainly hope you are not doing them all by yourself. It is time to delegate. If you have kids, a great app for teaching responsibility around the house and financial responsibility is called Homey. For spring cleaning, there are certain one-off jobs that you want to assign, but for the rest of the year, there are everyday responsibilities, and Homey offers settings for them both. If you don't even know where to start, you can pick from a preset chore list, set a due date, customize how often the recipient needs to do the chore, and you can even add a value to the chore, then connect a bank account to automatically pay your kids for chores. If you don't want to attach a bank account, then they will help you automatically track your IOUs. This is a blessing for anyone who has struggled with allowance for kids because who carries cash anymore? Now, some experts say you should not pay your kids to do chores. Homey says it's all about rewarding responsibility in order to maximize motivation. I say you know your kids better than the experts, so do whatever works for you. My favorite thing about Homey is that when a task is done, you just sweep it away. It's so satisfying that that is my reward. Because let's face it, nobody is paying parents to do chores in their own home. As soon as you figure out how to do that with technology, please let me know. If you want more tips for spring cleaning your digital life, check out My Digital Cleanse. You can find it on YouTube just by searching for Digital Cleanse. I'm Megan Maroney.
Homey, don't play that, Megan. All right, are you ready? what are you laughing?
Sorry, nothing.
I've been hoping an earthquake would hit, to be honest.
Well, right now.
If suddenly, because I've got it right here, quake alert too. If suddenly I leap under the table, my suggestion would be follow me, because I've got early warning. Joining us right now via Skype, Josh Basham. He's the founder of Early Warning Labs. Hi, Josh.
Hey, guys.
Now, this is, I'm guessing from the name Quake Alert 2 that this is not your first app.
No. This is the second iteration, actually.
So what's new? What's different between this and your first Quake Alert?
It's better.
Okay, that's good.
That's, oh, bravo.
It's new and improved. All right, good.
New and improved. We made some privacy changes. We allowed people to have a little bit more ability to be able to select a static address or allow us to do the location services. So we thought that was going to be an important update for people.
If people want to go to the website, earlywarninglabs.com, that's where this comes from, right? Early Warning Labs.
Yeah. So we have a wait list there that people can sign up. Or people can actually download it and enter their email there to get on that early access.
And your business at Early Warning Labs is actually selling this information to companies, kind of early warning, because companies need, you know, if they can, even 30 seconds is going to make a big difference, right?
Yeah. So working with people like LA Metro, right? So we actually connect our hardware solution into their PA system in the operations center.
Oh, wow.
So when there is a big earthquake, it'll actually notify the operators, and they'll slow and stop all the trains, all 100 trains here in LA, which
and
is
huge.
That was vital
and
in the
huge.
Yeah. I mean, that was vital in the 2011 earthquakes. They managed to get all their trains stopped because they had this 30-second warning. So the actual really limited the number of deaths.
Now, this is an earthquake prediction.
Correct. Yep. It's not prediction. We still can't predict earthquakes. It's simply early detection.
Okay.
But you do get a significant time period before the earthquake hits. How exactly does that work?
Yeah.
So, like you said, detecting the P waves. So, what's nice is the P waves are emanated out of the earthquake faster than the S waves, and the S waves are the ones that really cause most of the damage. Those are traveling roughly at the speed of sound. So, if we can theoretically detect those at the speed of light, right, with the sensor network and the high speed telemetry, we can actually send those alerts ahead of the earthquake faster than those S waves are propagating. That's where we get that big chunk of warning time.
Now, I set my Quake Alert 2 to have my location, but I also turn on location change. So as I travel around California, now, by what we should point out, this is what, California, Oregon, what areas of the country do you cover right now?
Yeah, so the ideal sensor density has been reached in Southern California and up in NorCal as well.
Okay.
But we also have coverage in Washington and Oregon. They have a lot less sensors than we do down here in California, but they're working really hard to increase that number of sensors right now.
And who runs those sensors? Is that the U.S. Geological Survey?
Yeah, so that's our official partner, the USGS.
Okay.
Okay, it's interesting because I was in my very first earthquake after coming here wasn't in California. It was on the East Coast with the Virginia quake. And we knew about it before the earthquake actually hit because people's Twitter was going, earthquake, and then all of a sudden it started shaking. So it's that speed of light versus speed of sound.
Those are the S waves, exactly. Though. So as the earthquake hits close to the epicenter, the center of the earthquake, those people tweeted, and the tweet spread faster than the S wave spread through the ground to you. But this is even faster than that, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so top end, you know, best case scenario, we can do 90 seconds here in California. But, you know, it's going to be a very, very rare instance. Realistically, you know, it's in the lower, you know, teens, maybe 20, 30 seconds.
And there is some latency in the phone itself, isn't there? I mean, it's going to take a while once you get that signal to send it out through the internet and then have the phone respond.
Yeah. So there's challenges. There's a lot of challenges with the mobile alerting. The app that we have is free. It's a best effort solution. That's why, you know, having a solution like our commercial solution that connects to the fire alarms and plays the alerts.
That's a little
entire
faster.
Building.
Got it.
Is just way more reliable because certain things like WEA, right, or the Amber Alert system, they measure their delivery times in minutes, if not tens of minutes, and it's just too slow. So the best thing we can do is use the push notification option for mobile apps, but still there's issues with that as
your
well.
Your timing was good, though. Here's a tweet. There were people in the earthquake that just happened a couple of days ago in Southern California who had your app and knew ahead of time. So it did work.
It worked. Yes, it worked.
Now, yay!
There's an asterisk to that, though. Because of those privacy changes, this instance here that you're showing, actually, it had only when I used the app for when we could actually locate the user. So it hadn't been open for a long time as an earthquake early warning app hopefully isn't used very much, right? We didn't know exactly where that user was. So they actually got an alert based off of their previous location. It was immediately when they opened the app, it was updated. But they would have had a little bit less than the warning time that was shown. But
so I've turned on always show my location. Yeah. Is that going to kill my battery?
It shouldn't.
Okay. No. And then I turn on, just because it's interesting, I want to know every earthquake that happens.
And I apologize in advance for when we wake you up at 2 in the morning after a long day.
There's an earthquake 180 miles away.
Well, also, I mean, you're close to Geyserville. So, I mean, that place has like 10 quakes a day. Sorry, Geyserville.
You know, okay, I'm 61, but I wouldn't call myself close to Geyserville. Would you mind?
Okay, Geyserville.
Wait till you're my age.
In this country, but, you know.
Geyserville, yeah. Because Geyserville... It tells you it's got thermal geysers. That means there's probably earthquake activity.
Oh, if you look
area.
On the USGS map, then it's just like spots of earthquakes all over the place.
We are in earthquake country.
There, to be honest.
Now, I can simulate. In fact, I'll do that right now, an arriving earthquake, so people will see what would happen.
Take it from weak to extreme. If you click weak,
violent. Oh, really? Yes. What's going to happen? Oh, my God. All right. Start the simulation. Are you ready? Yes. Drop and cover, drop, hold on. Okay, that's not too bad. I think I have the sound turned off. Would I be hearing a big loud...
I look at this desk and I think it's going
to... It's real! Let me do that again with the sound turned up. Because would there be an alert as well?
Yeah, so what's...
This
cool
is
about
a test.
Oh, jeez.
Earthquake, violent shaking.
Wow. Grief. Can you imagine just being falling off to sleep generally at about midnight and then that goes off? It's like, crap.
Now in Geyserville for sure. Wow, that's cool. So you're telling me if I leave this on, then I'm just going to hear this kind of stuff. All right, I get it now why I might not want to have that on at night. But you know what? Maybe I would, because it might give me the chance, just a few scant seconds, to get to safety.
If it gives you enough time to get under something sturdy, then, you know.
Well, I often at night...
We'll allow users to change that threshold in the next release that we release this summer. So, you know, people can actually have have it on and not worry that something silly is going to wake him up in the middle of the night. Right.
Well, as you could see, because I had my notifications turned off, I did not hear anything, so that wasn't too bad. You can change the event ordering by date of event, by distance from epicenter, by magnitude power, by shaking intensity felt. You can have a topographic map. This is really nice for free, especially a nicely done app. And actually, one of the things I really like about this is what to do preparing for an earthquake, and this is valuable information. I understand that this, earthquake is something unique to certain areas of the
world. Well, no, because I learned something we were discussing earlier, because my understanding when I first came over here, everyone said was, if there's an earthquake, get into a doorway.
We don't do that anymore.
But apparently this is not the case anymore.
Nope.
Drop, cover, and hold on. The best thing you can do,
that's the new thing.
Yeah. Prevent roughly half the injuries if you do that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So this is really cool, and it's and actually, even just for letting me know about earthquakes around
in the area, yeah.
I and we do live, as you can see, this is just a few days worth of activity. We do live in an area where there's a quite a bit of activity. We have a fault that goes right through Petaluma. So all right, good.
Well, when I came over, I've always been told that pets are very good at sensing earthquakes, and then when I was actually awake for the Napa one at about 2:30 in the morning or something. And before it happened, the cat just sat there looking bored, licking itself. And then while it was going on, the cat just looked bored and licked itself and didn't run around. It was like, you're useless, Boo. This is not good. I like the idea of this app a lot better.
The last earthquake we had here that I felt, I was the only one in the family who felt it. I jumped, leapt out of bed and ran around in a circle going, earthquake, earthquake, earthquake. But that really wasn't useful. So I'm going to have to, maybe we have some rehearsals.
Your dad was a geologist, right?
Yeah, my dad knows all about this stuff. How did you know that? That's exactly right. So I should be a little bit better prepared.
We scraped your Facebook feed.
Too soon, mate, too soon.
So you're planning to make this public soon?
We're hoping to get the final approvals for this this to be released this summer.
Is that Apple or the Geological Survey, or who is it that has to give you approval?
So we're coordinating with both the USGS along with the state and local as well.
Okay.
And are you going to be extending this to Android as well as iOS?
Yes.
Marvelous. That's because that's we need. I presume this works best when you've got the largest number of phones on it all detecting. Because presumably you're getting feedback
as well. Do you use phone data as well?
So actually, we don't use the sensor data from the phone. Although Berkeley, UC Berkeley was working on a really cool product. It was either MyShake or I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but they were actually using Android phones and using sensor in there to detect earthquakes.
Tried that one, and it did kill your battery life because it was all the sensors had to be on all the time.
But mine said either there's an earthquake happening or you're having a really good time right now. All right. I don't think the phone sensors are going to work as well as the P sensors.
No, I would rather have the P sensors, to be quite frank, because you want that early warning. It can make all the difference, just getting enough time.
Josh, can people apply to get this early? I got it early because we know somebody, you. But can people apply to get this early now on the website, or is there any way to get involved?
Yeah, they can either sign up on the website, or they can actually download the app and plug their email.
Okay. And are you giving out invites now, or is that...
So we're not doing that now, but the people that actually sign up will be the first ones invited to use it.
Nice. Excellent. Really cool. Earlywarninglabs.com if you want to know more about the service that they provide people like the LA Metro. And if you want to get the app, you can get it there or just search for Quake Alert 2, one word, Quake Alert, II for 2, on the App Store. I found it right away using that. The App Store is always a little flaky finding things, but maybe it's easier to go from the website. Yeah. And then Android folks, you're going to be able to get it in a few months. Thank you, Josh. This is really cool. I hope we have an earthquake. Well, I don't really.
Just don't push it, mate. Seriously.
But it was so cool to know before anybody else. I could say, I bet we're going to have an earthquake. How much? You want to bet $10? $10. We're going to have an earthquake.
I was thinking, grab the wife and cat and get into the bed. No. Let's have a bet on this.
I've been living in California for too long to worry about earthquakes. Thank you, Josh. I appreciate it.
Cheers, you guys.
Josh Basham, founder of Early Warning Labs at earlywarninglabs.com. Now, it's time for a call for help. On the line from Perth Amboy, New Jersey, Miguel. Hello, Miguel.
Hey, how are you, Leo?
I'm great. Thanks for hanging on. We're going to get Miguel's picture up here in just a second. There he is. How are things in Perth? Did you get snow in Perth Amboy?
Yes, we did. About 2 weeks ago, we did.
Now, there was another storm going through New York, I think, a couple of days ago, too.
Yeah, my in-laws are in New Jersey, and they got snowed in the other week. It was just
weird weather. So what can we do for you today, Miguel?
Yes, I was wondering if you have any recommendations on Wi-Fi hotspot for my Surface Pro 4. I use my computer on while traveling, like let's say for on planes and also in airports and also in public areas. Mm-hmm. I just like to know if you have any recommendations on hotspot Wi-Fi.
So obviously, a plane is not a good place to use.
No. They tend to frown on that one, but the airport is a great place to use it. Spend time sitting around.
I recently bought one of the first Windows on ARM computers, the new HP NVX2.
Oh, right, yeah.
And that has an LTE slot. Actually, Microsoft now, for a significant premium, makes a Surface Pro that has an LTE chip in it.
You do pay through the nose for that.
But it's a great thing. This X2 gets 20 hours of battery life. Plus, I'm always connected. It's a little slow because it's running on a Snapdragon, but I just love the idea that I don't have to think about it. I'm always connected. I have to admit, there's Wi-Fi everywhere now.
Up to a point, but I mean, I just wanted to ask, I mean, have you considered using your phone as a hotspot? Because, I mean, a lot of phones now, you've got the ability to turn it into a hotspot, so that's one possibility.
I have used it also, but it kind of runs my battery life on
right,
my phone,
that's true.
And I do want to avoid that.
Yeah, okay.
So the ideal hotspot would have good battery life.
Yeah.
Preferably a day, right? 10 hours to 15 hours.
That's really what you need, yeah.
It would be work on a variety of LTE signals.
So
in fact, ideally,
SIMs. Yeah.
It would even work overseas. I guess you'd need a new SIM if you went to...
Well, no, if you've got a virtual SIM in there, then it can reconfigure itself for various things. Yeah.
Here's the number one thing in my book, you pay as you go.
Yes.
I think, you know, generally with pay-as-you-go solutions, you pay more up per gigabyte, but you only pay for the gigabytes used.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems with the phone hotspot is you pay every month whether you use it or not.
Yeah.
I don't like that. So I would be looking for something that had those attributes. I used for some time the Karma Go. They actually have a new Karma Go. This is exactly what you're talking about. It's an LTE hotspot. It's light. Now, they say 6 to 8 hours of charge, and that's exactly what I was getting. So that's a little light. They do have a new one that has, it looks like VPN and an anonymity. It's a little expensive. It does work. Mine worked on the Sprint network, and I think that's all they use still is the Sprint network. And the thing that really disappointed me about Karma Go is they changed the plans to a subscription plan.
Yeah.
I used to pay $10 a gigabyte. And I really liked that. They still have a pay-as-you-go, $3 a month, though. But that, I guess, is a little better than, you know, whatever, $79 a month for 10 gigabytes. Let's throw that one out. I don't think the Karma Go is the right solution. What else do you have?
Well, I was talking to somebody about this, and they recommended, I haven't used it myself, they recommended this thing called Skyroam.
I'm tempted to get this for our trip to Japan, because this works internationally. Right?
Yeah, it's international. It's both a hotspot and a battery pack, so you can charge up your phone from it while you're using it, although that will cut into battery life a bit. But it is, coming back to the payment thing, $8, unlimited data for the day. Now, that there's no subscription fee,
I understand that.
So that would mean that you could use it just when you need to use it. You don't have to be constantly paying for something that you're not using. It appears to have a virtual SIM which can work with pretty much any network and in a lot of countries as well.
So this is kind of like, I don't know, GoGo Internet or Boingo, where you're buying a day pass, basically.
Yeah.
But it's in your pocket.
Yes, exactly. It's not like the in-flight Wi-Fi, which is up and down like the Assyrian Empire most times.
I like this that it's also 5 gadgets at once. So I really like the idea of this if you're traveling. When we were in the UK, we got from Three, which is one of the UK providers, one of these little MiFi-style cards. It was a flat rate, so I didn't have to worry about it. I carried it in my pocket, and we just made sure that the phone was set to Wi-Fi, that the laptop was set to Wi-Fi. So Lisa's phone, my phone, all of our devices were set to that Wi-Fi that I was carrying around.
Right.
We never had to worry about data roaming charges. We could turn off data roaming and just get data through the hotspot. That was actually really convenient. Mm. I wish it had better battery life. That's why long battery life has become one of my key things. I don't know what the Skyrim offers, but it has a... I think it's going to be pretty good because it doesn't have a big battery pack.
Yeah, it's got a battery pack built in, so you can actually charge up your phone while you're using it in emergencies.
Wow.
The other one thing I always take to airports when I'm traveling is a little like three-plug adapter extension. Because you know what it's like trying to get a plug at an airport. People hog them. So if you just say, would you mind if I plug this in? You plug that into that, and you've got another two free plugs there. But I think, yeah, you need something with a decent battery life. And thankfully now planes have, an awful lot of planes over here have their own power points as well, so you can recharge it in between, you know, in flight. And I'll make sure it's nice and ready when you get to the airport.
I'm going to buy one of these for a trip to Japan. Okay. And we'll see how it works. What I do is I have a Google's Fi service, which works fine in Japan. And I get, not fast, not LTE, but 3G, maybe 2G sometimes service, unlimited for free, plus cheap calls and unlimited texting.
Right.
I also have T-Mobile, and that works pretty much the same way.
There you get, GPRS.
And they claim, but I have to say, sometimes I get LTE service. So I think it really depends where you are and how they've set up the service. Mm. So I'm going to bring those two to Japan. And in the past, that's really been enough, especially given the Wi-Fi nowadays is everywhere. But let me get one of these. They allow you, they're two different ways of doing it. You can buy it if you're going to use it all the time. Or the device itself.
You can
rent it. And they say if you're only going to use it once a year, you might want to rent it. It's $9.95 rental per day. And I presume that includes the bandwidth. So it's $1.95 more than just paying for the bandwidth, right?
But compared to the amount of the charges you get charged by some commercial Wi-Fi providers,
that's going to save you a lot of money, yeah.
Yeah.
So I have heard a lot of good things about this. This is Skyrim. And it has good battery life. It has a day rate, which I like even better, really, than a gigabyte.
Well, yeah, I mean, a day rate with unlimited data, which is because I'm sick of data overage charges.
Right.
It's just such a pain.
And if you're going to be gone for a long time, they say 16-hour battery life. That's now we're cooking with gas. Oh, you know what else I like? USB-C connector. Mm-hmm. I am so tired of devices that still have micro USB. I just want to bring USB-C with me on all my trips because everything I use, except for the iPhone, charges with USB-C. So this looks like a pretty good choice. We don't have direct experience, Miguel, but does that seem like something you would be interested in?
Skyrim, I would think so, yes. Yeah. It's a possibility. Yes, it would be.
Yeah. Hmm. There's also, you mentioned Alcatel has
the T-Mobile
Link
Zone. T-Mobile are very keen on this. It's mainly, it seems to be their key, their main hotspot these days. But, I mean, it's small, it's relatively convenient. But
tells me no battery life.
Yeah, exactly. You don't get... I would prefer to have a lot more battery life and have something slightly chunkier than have something, it doesn't do a bulge in your pocket, but how long does it last for? You see, they're saying 6 hours, which is really pushing it. I would want ideally 8, because the amount of time you can get stuck in airports just trying to, get stuff done and having to keep an eye on the battery power the whole time is not fun.
I'm buying my Skyrim Solus right now, and I will $149. And then, as we said, $8 or $9 for a day pass.
Yep.
Unlimited. That sounds like a pretty good deal. And they have a $99 for the whole month.
Yeah.
So that sounds like a pretty good deal if you were going to do a lot of traveling. Do you travel a lot, Miguel? Or is this just around Perth Amboy?
Mostly on vacations.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So
it seems like a good idea, and especially if you've got a family. Right.
Yeah.
If it's just me, maybe the $9 is going to be a lot. But if it's me, Michael, Lisa, it's my watch, it's my phone, it's my tablet.
Yeah.
I think I might get my $9. $9.
You get your money's worth for that.
Yeah, I think so. So there's three choices for you. We don't have direct experience with any of those. Verizon has a travel pass for $9.99 a day. I think that a lot of cell phone companies now do that. But again, that drains the battery on your cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the idea of one Wi-Fi device that everybody's attached to. I
think
that
seems like
a great way to do it. But if you bought a power bank and plugged your phone into it and used it as a hotspot, that might be another way to go. Well, I'll come back from Japan May 5th, and I'll give you a report on the May 12th screensavers. How about that?
Perfect.
Thanks, Miguel. Hey, it's great to talk to you.
And Leo.
Uh-oh.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to add that I've been watching you from way back, from the days of Tech TV back in the late 90s. And in the past few months, I've been I'm proud to see that you have come back.
You're going
to
make me cry, Miguel.
That's really awesome.
I remember Megan. Back then, Adam Sessler.
Yep.
Martin Sargent.
Yep.
All of you guys. I mean, I think you guys have put my knowledge in technology way up there.
You must have been a kid when you started watching.
I was like maybe 17, 18 years old.
Thank you. You know, I hear this a lot, and it makes me happy every time because I feel like we made a lot of geeks in our days. Tech TV started as ZDTV in 1998.
Sean in our office watched it back then.
Yeah. Continued through till about 2004. They sold it to Comcast, moved it to LA. I parted company with them at that point. But those years for me between 1998 and 2004 were just as exciting and important for me as I think for a lot of the people I meet all the time. And guess what? May 11th, which is a month off, we are going to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the launching of ZDTV.
Wow.
20 years ago. So, Miguel, maybe we'll do something on the screensavers the next day. I don't know.
Awesome.
Thank you, Miguel, for your nice words. Thank you very much. Makes me feel like my road to Geezerville has been paid.
You're not going to let that go, are you?
Thanks, Miguel. Take care. Coming up next, it's going to be Patrick Norton next week on the new screensavers. And if you'd like to ask my old buddy, I should have mentioned this to Miguel from the screensavers. Here's how you'd ask him a question.
Need tech help? The new screensavers are here with answers. Email your tech questions to newscreensavers@twit.tv.
I got the feeling Miguel had just discovered that I'm still alive. Right? Didn't he say, oh, I just found you or something like that? I'm glad you still exist.
Oh, no.
I don't look a day older, do I?
You need to get one of the Spamalot shirts with not dead yet.
I'm not dead yet. The mailbag's coming up next, but first here's Jason Howell with some tips about where to stick your Google Assistant.
The Google Home Assistant has seen a lot of improvements over the past year, and very recently, you might have noticed Google rolled out an update called Routines to Assistant that allows for users to create a customized command that will in turn run a series of personalized actions that the Google Home can control in your home. It's super cool. You should totally check it out, but I'm not here to talk about that or any of the software inside the Google Home that you can use to get it to do cool things. I'm here to talk about a few ways that you can tackle the hardware itself to perhaps improve where inside your home you can put one of these things. So here are three Google Home hardware hacks that you can put into use right now or maybe a few days from now when these are shipped to you. First up, the Google Home Mini. I have tons of these in my home. It's a great little device with a form factor that can be hidden away on, let's just say, that available shelf tucked away on the side of your home. But one problem might be that you have no available shelf in that particular room that you want the Mini to live in. Well, do you have a power outlet in that room? Because check this out. For around $20, you can buy something like the Echo Gear outlet shelf. That's what you see right here. It's a miniature shelf that actually anchors on any power outlet that you have inside your home. You just install it into the wall. It's the perfect size for a Google Home. As you'll see right here, it's like a little shelf for your Google Home. Not only that, I picked up what you see here, this 15-amp USB outlet, as well as a 10-inch micro USB to USB cable, because that's what actually plugs into the back of your Google Home Mini. All in, I spent around $50, but at the end, what I have is a nice, streamlined, and clean-looking shelf and power station for my Google Home Mini. So not having a place to put it is no longer an issue. Secondly, perhaps installing a shelf around the outlet is just a bit bulky for your taste. If instead you want to, I don't know, hang your Google Home Mini below the outlet and save some additional space that way, you can actually do that. I headed over to Etsy and I found this. It's the My Mini Google Home Mini Outlet Mount for around $10. It's a 3D printed wall mount that fits the Google Home Mini snugly inside the large casing. And then you can wrap the cable throughout kind of the hidden channels inside of the casing and then resolve to the plug that's mounted up here. And with that, you can simply plug the My Mini into any available outlet and that Google Home Mini will stay mounted, just kind of hanging there, ready for your voice commands. And honestly, if you have a 3D printer and some time, I'm sure you could come up with something similar on your own. And finally, how about portability? We have the standard Google Home in our kitchen. It gets used about 90% of the time for just playing music, right? But I've often wished that I could just bring this outside when I want music. Say I'm working out in the yard or the kids are playing outside. I want this to be a portable stereo that I can take outside. Well, you're in luck because Loft creates a battery base that actually replaces the standard base on the Google Home. It's incredibly easy to install. You just pull off the old base with a light tug, and then you slide the Loft in. Boom. The Loft battery provides up to 8 hours of power when unplugged, but we keep it plugged in where it lives in the kitchen. And then when I want to take it outside, I just unplug it and bring it with me, and it's awesome. The Loft battery base for the Google Home runs $49.95, but actually right now it's selling for $39.95 on Amazon, and you can check it out there. I'm Jason Howell, and you can catch me on All About Android every Tuesday. You can also find me on Tech News Weekly every Thursday here on twit.tv.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you. So I ordered that Skyride. But it's interesting because we're going to Japan. I think you know that in a couple of weeks. And
I'm not jealous at all.
Kevin, who's visiting, who lives in Yokohama, he's a university student here in the States, but he lives in Yokohama, told me, you should get it because I just assumed you go to Japan, Wi-Fi is everywhere, right?
Well, yeah.
No, he said no. Wi-Fi is hard, and it's expensive, and it is not in a lot of the places you'd expect Wi-Fi here in the States. Every coffee shop has free
Wi-Fi.
I was
kind of disappointed by that because you'd think Japan would be ahead of the game.
I know.
You know, it's.
I know. So I'm glad I found that out. Thank you, Kevin, and I'm glad I have that Solus. There he is, and I will absolutely let you know when I get back if that was a good purchase or not. It's fun to be able to review that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, it's so nice to have you. Thank you.
No, Ian always fun. I really
enjoy
these.
Is now officially the news editor at the register.co.uk.
For
is that your
sins.
Title?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, please, Bravo. Please, please.
Well, we think the world of it, Ian, and we always love
having
you up
here. Oh, always fun to be
here.
Up here,
yeah. And the Register is fantastic. You know, you guys are getting so many good scoops these days.
It's interesting because it took us a while to break into the American consciousness, but now we're getting a lot of information coming in. We're going to have some really big stories.
Well,
next
I read
week.
About the black hole story in the Register. Mm. You have a great science reporter. What's her name?
Cassiana. Yeah,
she's great. I read about a lot of security things first. In the Register. You were the guys who broke the Spectre and Meltdown story.
Yeah, yeah, and Intel still haven't spoken to us.
You know what? You'll get used to it.
Yeah,
people don't talk to me either. Let's get the mailbag in here, and look at that. Here's your tinfoil hat. Very convenient. Very convenient. You get that one. And Jerry obviously has
things
a small,
I never thought I'd do.
Small child. Because his that looks good on you.
Colleen, maybe. Maybe just
Colleen, you made this? You
that's
know
a
how
great
to make,
job, Colleen.
Tinfoil hats. This is only going to protect part of my brain, unfortunately. We have, and not for very long, apparently.
If my mother could see me now.
We have emails. Ian, pick one. You get to read. Oh,
I'll go for that one.
I can only. I have to keep my head upright. I'm sorry.
Oh,
email numero uno comes from Corey. Hello. In the next few weeks, I'll be returning to the U.S., Nebraska, after 22 years of living in Germany. Wow.
That's culture shock of an epic level.
I was wondering what the gotcha things are going to be in regard to technology. Things such as data plans and normal everyday technology and living matters.
Yeah, well, basically take the amount of money you're spending on data at the moment and triple it.
Is it really that much worse?
Oh, the amount you get shafted for when it comes to mobile phone access, broadband access. I mean, I don't know what the market's like in Nebraska, but even in Silicon Valley, there's very little choice of ISPs.
That's actually, I think, the biggest, saddest thing in the United States. Mm. We invented the internet, and oftentimes the first country to do something is the one that's got the least modern infrastructure, because our infrastructure goes back to the days we invented the internet. But something worse happened in the United States, and that was when the big broadband providers lobbied the FCC, and they said, look, it's going to cost us a lot of money, cable companies, to dig trenches and put in cable. We would like a monopoly. We would like it so that people can only get their internet from us. Yeah. And the phone company said, you know, we spent a lot of money making this phone system. We would like a monopoly. And they even said, and this is the thing that scared the FCC the most, we'll not do this infrastructure unless you give us this monopoly. Mm. You're not going to see internet everywhere unless you give us this monopoly. This goes back several decades. FCC did, and they created what is effectively a duopoly situation. About 86% of Americans have really only two choices, the cable company and the phone company, for their internet. I'm sure it'll be that case in Nebraska, although because Nebraska's so flat, you might have the possibility of
wireless.
Mm. And I think in a lot of parts of the Midwest, wireless internet service providers are getting more and more common because, as in Nebraska, people are very spread out. One of the biggest problems we have in the United States is in areas with low population density, there's no incentive for these providers to put in infrastructure.
There was an incentive, and they were given a massive tax break at the turn of the century.
Oh, that's tax break, schmacks break.
You know, it hasn't been followed through. And one of the things, I mean, I have friends in Germany. I have a friend in Finland who's paying what? I think it's €32, so equivalent to about $40, for a gigabyte up and down to his home.
In many countries, Finland's one, you had the infrastructure put in by the government.
Yeah.
And so, in effect, it's government subsidized. It's not a private
They put the infrastructure in, but then they let competition go on within that infrastructure.
And if we were going to start over from scratch, that would be the way to do it. But it's not going to happen. And that's one of the, I think, the side effects of being one of the first in any technology is you often get a more haphazard solution because it's just whatever happened. Yeah. Then other countries can look at it and say, oh, the right way to do this is to have government.
But you see, we had the same problem in the UK in that initially internet, broadband was done using copper wire that had been laid down by the phone companies. And initially it was just one company, BT, the former national carrier, and a few other tiny competitors. And then the government said, look, we have to do this thing called local loop unbundling, which means, you own the infrastructure and you can get a reasonable profit running it. And if you want to provide commercial internet or personal internet, you can do that as well, but you've got to unbundle and allow other companies to get in there so you've got a competitive market. And you used to have this in the US. And then I think it was late 90s. The rules changed slightly, and it became possible for the big players to squeeze out the smaller ones.
Cable, it's really strange. Cable never had to do that.
Right.
So cable always owned the infrastructure and the sole right to put internet over it. Mm-hmm. Phone companies have been compelled to let other DSL providers use the phone lines.
Right.
But what's happening now, that kind of stimulated the phone companies to put in fiber where they didn't have the same rules.
Yes.
And in fact, a lot of times when Verizon comes in and puts in fiber, they cut the copper.
Yeah.
So there's no way that any other internet service provider
can get onto it.
It basically guarantees a monopoly.
So we really struggle
with that in the United States, and I don't think we have a good solution to it.
Well, this is one of the big hopes of Google Fiber, because they said they were going to build these networks and they will be open and you can compete on them. But as it turns out, Google's now severely cut back on fiber deployments. So we're now a little bit shafted. And it just seems bizarre that in Silicon Valley we get such poor service. And I'm afraid, mate, in Nebraska, it's unlikely to be much better. I may be wrong. I haven't actually been there
myself.
Depends
if you're in the city. If you're in the country, you might be really out of luck. But if you're in Lincoln, for instance, somebody's looking at the directory and they said you can get, it was a pretty good deal. I can't remember. $140 for 10 gigabits, something like that. So in the cities, the denser the population, the more likely you're going to have some choices.
But with Germany, they have a functioning competitive mobile market, so your mobile costs are going to be a lot lower. They've got a functioning internet market, so again, the costs are going to be that much lower. I have to say, you're in for a real, really big price shock, mate. It's not going to look good.
Yeah. As for other technology items, I don't think that there's any difference in the kinds of goods you can get. I think it's probably the same. Although
many
of these American companies don't. They inflate because of exchange rate issues. They inflate the price in overseas. But in the United States, you're probably going to get a better deal on Apple equipment, Dell equipment.
Oh, we used to give Apple hell about this because iTunes pricing, it's 99 cents in the US, 99 pence in the UK, which
it's
is
not
a
the
huge
same
markup. it was a huge markup before Brexit and the pound plummeted. But even so, it's... Yeah.
I think in general, though, I think
you
it's
do
not
get cheaper consumer electronics here.
Yeah. I think in the long run, it's gonna be a wash. And welcome back to the States. It's great to have you. What do you have there?
Okay, I've just tried to send an email from my AOL account, and the draft had information from a PR company that I'd never heard of in the signature. I then went into my deleted folders and saw a number of message error emails. It looks like someone has hacked my account and is sending emails. I do have a very strong password, and I never click on things that I don't recognize. Good on you. So how could this have happened? This is from Mindy. Now, My first thought was go on to Troy's website and just...
Have I been pwned?
Yeah. It may be that you've reused a password, or you've used a password that you used like 10 years ago and forgot about.
Can you take anything a guy in a tinfoil fez says?
You really? Made me wear this.
Okay.
No. All right, I'll wear it. My turn.
But yes.
No, so have I? It's have I been? Have I been pwned.com.
And that's a really good way to check if particular accounts have been hacked. It does look, from what you're saying, as though someone's taking control of this and is using it. But the PR message had me, the PR email thing had me slightly confused.
It sounds like it might be a bug or something weird.
Could be a bug. It might be worth checking in.
That is always the symptom, though. When people say, "Has my email been hacked?" I always say, "Go look in the sent bin."
Yeah.
And if you see in the sent folder a lot of emails you didn't send,
then
you have been hacked.
I've got to say, I'm a bit of a snob about this, but dump the AOL account. You know, it doesn't look good.
I kind of have to agree with you on that one.
We had someone send in their resume we're hiring tech reporters at the moment, and they put their address as such at hotmail.com.
Is that a mark against them?
I'm afraid it was. I know it sounds really, really bad to say this, but if you're still using Hotmail, it's not a good look.
The next best would be Gmail. The best would be your own domain.
Yes, your own domain, or maybe something like
Leo at aluminumshriner.com. I worry, Mindy. I mean, it's hard for us to tell from remote control if you've got a problem. Those certainly are symptoms of a
and it could also be that it isn't actually a problem with the email client itself. It's more general. You've been hacked problem.
Yeah.
They have a keylogger on there, so no matter how strong your password is going to be, they'll pick it up.
Oh my god!
So maybe do a full system scan.
Out of her.
Well, only the paranoid survive. You know this. But, so it would be a good idea just to do a complete system scan, make sure you're not harboring any nasties in there. Then change the password again for something strong and see if it works out.
Do you get the scenario that he's talking about here? He's saying not only has a hacker got some malware on your system, but he's gotten so deep in your system that he's seeing everything you type.
Yeah.
So even if you so the first thing, obviously, and I hope you did this, Mindy, is to change your AOL email. Mm-hmm. But if you still see emails going out over your email, then maybe that is true, that the guy is actually watching your keystrokes.
It's one of the first things that they will put on there as a keylogger. And back in the old days, when keyloggers were kind of invented by the hacking community, they were lousy because they just collected every single keystroke. So the guy that gets his document dump is just like, how the hell do I pick stuff out? But now they're getting smarter. If you go to specific websites like your email provider, like your banking provider, that's the only time they'll kick in, because they just want that useful information, not the letter you're writing to Auntie Doris on Word. So, it's just do a full system scan. To be honest, everyone should be doing a full system scan at least every 3 months.
Do you go to antivirus.com to do that, or ESET?
They're not paying me to say this, but I happen to use Malwarebytes as a...
And they have an online scan, or you keep it running on your system?
No, you keep it running on your system.
Oh, I wouldn't do that. I don't like that at all.
It's a bit of a pain, but, oddly enough, I was speaking to an NSA, one of the guys who used to be part of the NSA's hacking squad, and he said the first thing they go for is security software, because it's got root access.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
How many times, and this is a debate, actually, I want to sit down with Steve Gibson. This is a debate that I go through personally, because I tell people not to use antivirus software, because it is soft. First of all, any software you put on your computer is going to have flaws and potentially open holes. Antivirus software is really more dangerous because it usually has low-level access. It's often hooked into the kernel. Mm-hmm. So, as you said, it is a target. We know, for instance, we believe that the Russians got the NSA software tools because an NSA contractor brought home the hacking tools. Mm. He had Kaspersky's antivirus running on there. This was the version of Kaspersky that had an internet connection. This seems like a good idea, right? An antivirus with an internet connection is always downloading new antivirus signatures, always up to date, right? That's one of the problems with antiviruses.
Yeah.
They can't keep up to date fast enough. But the problem is it also had a mechanism in it, the quarantine mechanism, to send data from the host computer back to Kaspersky. Mm. And that mechanism was used to take the NSA hacking tools and export them to Russia.
Yeah, I mean, what they say is that they've been doing some research on equation group hacking tools and then it pulled it in.
I don't buy it.
I'm not sure who to believe on this one.
In my opinion, and this is a worthy debate. Maybe you and I should sit down and have this debate. The problem with security tools is they give you a false sense of security.
That is true.
They open holes into your system that didn't exist before. And we've heard from many major antiviruses that they've had exploits. Norton's had exploits. McAfee's had exploits. Kaspersky's had exploits that allowed bad guys into your system. Not farthest from protecting you, they actually allowed bad guys into your system.
But you see, the counter argument to that is I basically use my mother's is the excuse.
Your mother should have an antivirus.
If you're not particularly tech savvy, then it can be a good backstop. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, as a general rule of thumb, never ever click on any attachment that you don't recognize intimately who it came from. You know, be aware, keep your systems constantly updated. There was a great bit of software which they're pulling next month. It's a PSI. Sacunia made it.
Yeah.
That's being shut down now. I got an alert on it. They're shutting it down end of the month.
Why?
Apparently, the company that bought it doesn't want to maintain it.
Yeah.
But this was a great bit of software.
That's another problem.
Scanned all the applications on your system and told you which ones need updating. And you need a bit of software like that on your system.
First thing I would tell your mom, stop running Windows. But that's another story for
me. I'm tempted to put it onto a Chromebook, to be honest, because that would save me an awful lot of tech support.
Better than getting an antivirus, get a Chromebook. Anyway, so good to see you.
A pleasure, as always.
Thank you all for watching, for sending your questions.
Yeah, big audience today. Thanks for coming.
And thanks to our studio audience. We always love having people in studio. If you want to be here, just email tickets@twit.tv and we'll make sure we have a spot for you. If you can't be here in person, you can always watch live on the video stream. That's twit.tv/live. And if you do that, I encourage you to join us in the chat room. Lovely people in there. IRC.
There are indeed. And plus, if you log in a little early, you can see all the kerfuffle that goes on beforehand. And
always fun. Yeah, watching live. Words. Yeah, yes. Yeah, watch all the English swear words. if you can't be here in person or during our live stream, which is, by the way, Saturday afternoons, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2200 UTC, you can always get on-demand versions of everything we do. Most people, that's how they watch or listen. We have audio and video at twit.tv/NSS, or get your Pocket Cast, your Overcast, your Stitcher, your TuneIn Internet Radio, your Apple iTunes podcast, your Google Play, whatever you listen to, subscribe. That way you'll get every episode. You know what I do? I get up in the morning and I tell my Echo, I say, Echo, listen to the new Screensavers. And it just plays magically. It just plays. So that's
how you see, I refuse to have one of those things in my house, so I have to get the phone and push a button like that and then it plays it to me. But
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, no, I don't.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, yeah. It's an old-fashioned way, but, you know, I also adjust my thermostat by hand as well.
What?
Oh, I know.
You're crazy.
And I welcome you to a barn raising next time.
What you really need is a tin foil hat like this.
Then you don't have to worry.
They even covered, because, you know, nowadays, if you're not covering the tassel, you're wide open. Wide open. Tassel in the middle attacks. Don't knock it. We thank you for watching. We'll see you next time on the new Screensavers. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Wow, Alex, you've mastered the full function.